Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, my lovely Betwixters. It's me, Kate Lister. I am here with your fair dues warning, or specifically for this episode, ye oldie fair doozy warning. I don't think that's right at all. But I am here to give it to you anyway. You have to be warned that this is a podcast dealing with adult themes, where adults talk to each other about adulty things. And the adult that I am talking to in today's episode is Eleanor Yenager. And if you know anything about Eleanor, you'll know that, quite frankly, she lowers the tone considerably, that she has got a real potty mouth, and generally is just obscene and naughty, and there's nothing I can do to stop her. So, we will be talking about sex, we will be swearing. There's quite a long discussion about pubic hair as well, you know. And none of this is my fault because I'm very easily influenced and Eleanor is a terrible influence. But if you can stomach all of that, then let's get into it. Okay, Betwixters, close your eyes and picture a medieval woman. What have you got? What have you come up with? What's she doing? Is she churning butter? Is she tending to livestock? Is she singing romantically out of a tower window while a bluebird rests on her hand? Is she doing housework? What colour hair does she have? What do her teeth look like? What about her body? Is she hairy? Or can medieval women get Brazilian waxes in your imagination? Is she educated? Here's the thing, I don't know what you came up with, but medieval women tend to have a pretty bad rap in the public imagination. And today we are going to find out what it actually meant to be a proper medieval woman. What was a woman expected to be in this time? How easy was it to live up to these expectations? And of course, how hairy were they? Let's get into some fresh woolen blankets to find out.
What do you look for in a man?
Oh, money, of course.
You're supposed to rise when an adult speaks to you.
I make perfect copies of whatever my boss needs by just turning a knob and pushing a button.
Yes, social courtesy does make a difference.
Goodness, what beautiful time. Goodness has nothing to do with it, dearie.
Hello and welcome back to Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex scandal and society, with me, Kate Lister. At the time of recording, it is Women's History Month, a time when historians and multinational corporations alike consider how women's roles have changed throughout history. Posts on LinkedIn and Twitter and everywhere else talk about women from the 20th century, they talk about Tudor women, Cleopatra often gets a look in, but there's a regular absence of medieval women. And I think it's because we don't think of them as being very feminist, do we? We think of them as being locked away in towers, wearing chastity belts and waiting for Prince Charming to pull his finger out. Well, in order to try and dispel some of these myths and to find out what it really meant to be a medieval woman, I am overjoyed to have met up with the legend that is Eleanor Yenager, and she is here to talk about her new book, The Once and Future Sex, Going Medieval on Women's Roles in Society. This is her third time on the show. We can't keep her away. Check out her other episodes on ghosts and medieval sex wherever you manage to find this podcast. She's just far too much fun, she really is. And I hope that you enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. And welcome back to Betwixt the Sheets. It's only Eleanor Yenager again.
I live here now.
I know you do. A
There's no one else I'd rather have in my bed.
Babe.
You and Jason Momoa.
Yeah, okay, no, that's fair. That's fair.
You'd bring the history, though.
There's room for all of us.
I think so.
Yeah.
I bet he'd have an interest in medieval history. But anyway, enough of Jason. We are here because it's your book launch, babes.
I know.
How excited is that?
I'm really excited. It's my baby. I've been working on it, you know, for years
baby.
Now. Yeah, and now it's out in the world. It and she's very beautiful.
She is. This is a sexy book.
Mm.
The Once and Future Sex. Where did that title come from?
It's kind of a reference to The Once and Future King, which is about Arthuriana. So essentially what it's doing is flagging people up to the fact that this is a book about medieval things, but also what it's kind of hinting at is the fact that I'm talking about medieval women in the book, but also the idea that if we really dig into ideas about gender from the past, we can understand our own as well, and then hopefully make a more equitable future. Haha.
Nice.
Yeah.
Look
nailed
that,
that one.
Mm-hmm. So that process can go on for a fucking while, can't it?
Yeah. Oh god. Yeah. And that's the thing is that, and then they're gonna like have something really straight laced.
Because you now have a lot of trouble publishing anything with the word sex in
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Absolutely. So and it has maybe. It might hinder things a little bit, to be honest, because there are a lot of controls about literally selling anything that involves the word sex online.
Yep.
Because people don't think before they make laws. So,
no, they don't.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting because even if it's something like this, which is very much like a feminist book, it falls under these really kind of draconian measures that are, you know, really about keeping women in their place, right? Because they fall foul of Sesta Fosta, which is basically about keeping sex workers offline.
Yeah, can't have sex on the internet.
Exactly. And so, but it's a really interesting kind of way of thinking about how people like to think that sex work and sex workers is something that happens over there, and this is like a bad group of women that
yeah.
like, you don't need to worry about. But actually, you know, their struggle affects all of us.
Absolutely, it does. So this is definitely your brain baby. This is a labor of love. I want to ask you, like, where did it come from? What was the inspiration for this? But I think I just know it's because you're a committed pervert.
Oh, that's true. No, it kind of like started out like from being, you know, a committed pervert who gossips about dead people's sex lives
yep.
for a living. And one of the things that I, you know, continuously notice when you tell people, oh yeah, I work on medieval history and sex, is they are so confounded by the way that medieval people think about women and sex, because medieval people are like, oh, women are just these insatiable, horny sex monsters.
Yep.
All they want to do is have sex. And people are like, oh, that's so silly, because everybody knows that ladies hate sex, actually, you know, and I find that really interesting and important to talk about, because really the point of the book is that we are constantly changing what it is that we think women are all the time. You know, we explain what women are like constantly. And we then come to the conclusion, well, women are bad and they're less than men, right? So men are the good one and like women are bad. And the reason women are second class citizens is because of all these silly things about them. But we're constantly changing what's bad about women all the time. Because in the medieval period, it's like, oh, well, women are massively horny. So like you can't have them in public life because they'll just be humping chairs, you know?
Where did
like
that idea come from? I mean, were medieval women just masturbating frantically all over the place? And
I mean, I wouldn't put it past them. I'd like to believe yes, but it's actually a really, really old idea.
Okay.
So it comes to us really through the transmission from the classical period. So you ask anybody like Plato, Aristotle.
Oh, I knew they'd be involved.
Every time. And they're like, yeah, women are massively horny. And it's because even for the ancients, sex in and of itself is considered bad. And
okay.
So the idea here is that sex basically overrides all of your kind of intellectual.
I mean, it kind of does. I'd have to agree with him there. I've done some really fucking dumb things before.
Well, see, there you go. Because you're just an average woman, you know.
It's my lady brain. It's my poor
it's your lady brain.
Right?
And so the way that Aristotle looks at it, he says that women are kind of like inside out or deformed men.
He's losing me a bit now.
Yeah, he's a bit of a dick, right? And so women are kind of just the opposite of everything that a man is.
But opposite in a bad way.
In a bad way, yeah.
Right.
So men are like stoic and logical, and they can be ideal citizens, and they can like contribute to, you know, the Athenian discourse or whatever the hell. But women are stupid, horny lizard people who, you know, are basically just trying to fight all the time and also hump things. So the idea is that like men can overcome this, but women can't, right?
Right.
And so medieval people then, you know, they're just massively hard for any ancient, right? Especially Aristotle.
Yeah, they never updated their medical text, did they? It was very much about digging out the classics.
Mm-hmm. You just like look to the classics and then you kind of do this thing where you go, oh yeah, and Jesus on top of it. So, and when you add the Bible in, things are also like really point to, oh, well, women are horny, because you just go and you look at the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, but men are fucking on in the Bible too. Solomon with his 850 wives.
Yeah, but like that's fine.
That's all right, is it?
Yeah, but it's really interesting because you see all this kind of like mental gymnastics around that, right? Like even in the conception of medieval sex work, right? Where it's like, oh yeah, well sex work has to exist because, you know, if men don't have an outlet to have sex, then they'll just like riot and burn the city down. So you better have sex workers for unmarried men. So clearly men are like horny enough that they might like burn shit to the ground if they don't have access to sex. But women are the horny ones.
Yet you still see that rhetoric raising its head from time to time, like, especially around modern incel assholes. Like I occasionally see somebody saying, oh, can't sex workers have sex? Can't they pay to have sex?
Yeah.
And it's like, kind of like, don't offer sex workers up as some kind of buffer. It's like insane men.
It's like, oh yeah, oh, like that violent guy. Like,
that guy who murders people. Why don't you have sex with him?
Yeah, and this is the really interesting thing, because whenever you hear people say that, it's like, that's a genuinely medieval view.
That is, isn't it?
Yeah. Okay. And I'm constantly losing my rag because someone is like, oh, that's so medieval, like whenever just something is bad. And I'm like, this is a case where that's medieval.
Yeah. That is actually.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
Medieval. Right. So I'm trying to get like to the bottom of what did medieval people think of women? And this is it's a huge question because medieval, it's actually about 1,000 years of history, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a vast swathe.
Yeah. And obviously we know a little bit more about kind of the later period because, you know, it's just closer to us than, you know, further in the back. Like, you know, the 8th century is a really long time ago. But it's interesting because you can see kind of kernels of things in there that go along. But there's certain things. So, for example, I really talk about beauty standards a lot in this.
Yes.
And we spend a long time, like in the earlier medieval period, where we just don't really talk about what we think a hot woman is. And that's really much closer to the kind of ancient Greek way of thinking about things. So if you go back and look at like ancient Greek texts when they talk about what a hot woman is, which is what medieval people were doing, right? Because medieval people were like, I can't possibly think a woman is hot if Aristotle didn't think she was hot. Like, I wouldn't, how would I ever? So they go back and look at all these texts and they're like, okay, well, let's go see how they describe Helen of Troy.
Right.
Because she's the hottest
woman. How do they describe Helen of Troy?
She's blonde.
Right.
That's it.
That's it?
That's it. And also sometimes they're like, she's the cutest. Like, that is it. And so that's all we know. And then, like, you know, in descriptions of the Trojan Wars, like, sometimes Briseis or Polyxena, they will get described. And they're like, well, Briseis is tall. Polyxena, she's not tall.
Right, so lots of detail.
So, yeah, so there's, like, nothing at all to go on. And it's quite interesting because it's very much like a beauty is in the eye of the beholder type of situation.
Right, okay.
And then when you're in the earlier medieval period, when people describe women as being beautiful, they're just like, oh yeah, she's beautiful. And then like, that's it.
And then that's
no
that.
Detail, right?
Right.
Then from the 12th century forward, they're like, no guys, like we've got to get this down. And they kind of like come up with what a beautiful woman is. And it becomes really ossified. So they scan from the head down to the toes.
Who's scanning? Who's doing this? Who's
so
writing this?
It's like poets. So there's like this guy, Geoffrey of Vinsauf, who's like, he writes this whole basically guidebook on how to write poetry. And he's like, hey, if you want to describe a sexy woman, this is what a sexy woman is.
What does he say is a sexy woman?
Okay, so she's got blonde hair, a high hairline. You've got to have like...
I have a high forehead.
You're in, baby. Okay.
Right, okay.
You got to have arched eyebrows, preferably black.
I could nip to boots and get...
Okay, so gray eyes...
Blue eyes.
Yeah, like blue is okay, gray is better.
Okay.
A nose that is neither too big nor too small.
I think I'd do that. That's
okay. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah. White skin.
I did fake tan the other night.
Yeah, see that here, right? I'm no. Right. Yeah. And then you gotta have like a cheeks like roses.
Yeah, no, I'm, yeah.
A mouth like a rosebud, white teeth.
They could be white.
Yeah, well, they always could, right? A neck like a swan.
Definitely not. No.
Yeah. Small shoulders?
No.
Small high breasts?
No.
A pot belly?
Yes.
A dump truck ass.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, thick thighs.
Yes.
Feet.
I have feet.
There you go. So, you know, like, the checklist's pretty good, right?
I am medieval hot.
Yeah, there you go. So
I'd be on tapestries all over the ancient world.
Yeah, and it's like, that is what it is. And it,
really? They liked a fat ass and a pot belly?
Oh, God, yeah. They are like pear-shaped, baby. They're like, they don't want to see titties. They're like,
really?
Those titties better be up by your armpits.
You do see that in medieval paintings when it looks odd. It looks like the breasts are trying to go in different directions.
Yeah, and they're like, meep. Right, that's what they gotta be like. So, like, they're looking for that pear shape, and they are hardcore about it to the point where, you know, if I'm ever online and, like, posting pictures of, like, you know, a hot medieval babe who's naked, people are like, why is she pregnant? And I'm like, that's her luscious little belly.
Wow.
That's what they, and, you know, so now we just don't think that's hot at all, but...
God, it's not that I'm not hot. It's I was born hundreds of years too late.
You know, well, what I would argue, babe, is that perhaps creating an archetype that is really rigid of being like, the only way to be hot is this one thing, is a social construct.
And all right, yeah, that's right, we're not doing that. Okay,
because
yes. Oh, don't take that away from me. I was really excited then.
But this is like the thing, right? Because now when you see like women that we call hot, there'll be like all these nerd-ass nerds who are like, actually, it's evo-psychology, and we evolved this way to think that this particular woman is hot. And I'm like, oh, really? Because for 700 years, they wanted like chicks that were just like packing a booming system in the back, and like that's all they wanted. So it can't possibly be evolutionary. This is just social. And like, that's fine.
Is there anything that has been constant? I suppose being healthy, probably. Like things
cleanliness and good skin.
Cleanliness and good skin.
Yeah.
Sparkly eyes, probably.
Yeah, and that is always universal. So even now, there's only like a couple of universals in terms of what everybody finds attractive, and it's like cleanliness and good skin.
But see, even in the medieval period, washing yourself.
Yeah.
Very important. And if we can just say a public service.
Public service mountain that medieval people bathe. Oh my God, please. Thank you. Right. Please leave me alone.
Medieval people washed. They were really fastidious about it.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah, because it's very much a cleanliness is next to godliness sort of thing. It's, you know, keeping clean is, well, A, really comfortable, and everyone gets that.
Yeah.
And B, it's kind of like seen as keeping yourself pure in the same way that it is now, really.
It can't have been as easy to keep yourself clean. Because like, I rolled out of my hotel bed this morning and pretty much rolled into the shower, and there was free soap and like this antibac on hand. Medieval people, they didn't even have like running sewers.
Yeah.
So like how, if you, because we're in London right now, and if you're a medieval person in London and you want to keep clean, it must be quite tricky. So how do they do it?
Yeah, so what you would do when you rolled out of bed in the morning is you'd probably go stand in a wooden tub, and you would just take some water and just give yourself a good wipe down.
A hose wash.
Yeah,
that's what we used
exactly.
To call that.
Yeah. So you would like soap yourself up, you'd wash in like real quick.
Did
wash
they have
down.
Soap?
They have soap. Mm. And in fact, it's one of these things where soap massively kind of like expands as an industry in Europe, specifically during the Middle Ages.
What do they make soap out of?
They make it out of ash, lye, and oil.
Does that work?
It does, yeah. So it's like, it's pretty much the same recipe for soap from time, memorial, yeah. Yeah, so like, you know, big centers of soap production still exist. So like Marseille in France, like they were making soap then, they're making it now. Castile. Where so Castile soap comes
they
from.
They would have smelled French.
Yeah, they would have. But here's two things, right?
Right,
so rich people probably have that French soap. And rich people are probably like having, you know, the nice soap that comes from Italy and stuff. If you are a normal person, you probably make your own. But it's totally something that you can make and something that they do. So they make their own soap. You just give yourself a good washdown. Then, like, maybe once a week, you'd go for, like, the full bath.
That's because they had public bathing, didn't they?
Mm-hmm. So
that's something my students are always really surprised when I tell them that like, how many friends have you had that you've got in the bath with?
Yeah, and for them, it's just like, this is like the leisurely thing to do. You'd be like, come on, everybody, we're going down to the bathhouse, and you just
grab
like kick it. And you know, it's just like, it's spa day, and you know, it's just completely fine. But you got a really different understanding of kind of what privacy is in the Middle Ages. Like the idea of privacy is just like not there.
Okay.
You know, like you sleep kind of in a room with six other people, and you and the homies go get naked down the baths, and it's just not considered the same sort of way that we do now.
Okay, so there is soap.
Mm-hmm.
Where would they get water from if they lived in a city?
So in the city, there are wells and fountains and places that you would get that. Here, often too, people do get Thames water. Like you can go down to the Thames and do it, but a lot of the times it's wells and springs and stuff. So you have like fountains and stuff around.
Okay.
So that definitely exists.
So you've given yourself a bit of a hose wash until you can go with your mates and get in the tub with your neighbours as well, apparently. What about things like bad breath or combing your hair or makeup or anything like that? Like how do you put your face on in the Middle Ages?
Yeah, okay, so they do brush their teeth. They've got like little kind of twigs and stuff that they brush their teeth with. And interestingly, that's kind of as good as it gets until the 1960s. Because it's not until we started adding fluoride to toothpaste that toothpaste did anything. Like, it might make your breath smell good, but it's like, it is not fighting. Like,
it's like
the actual scrubbing is what cleans your teeth before then. So, fine. So, you know, it's pretty much exactly the same level. And probably they have better teeth than a lot of us do anyway, because they just don't have as much access to sugar.
Yeah.
Like, they are not eating cane sugar, like, constantly, because we're living that good life, baby. So, there's that. A lot of makeup. Girls will make their own. And we have lots of really cool recipe books about this. A big famous one is called the Trotula. And it was allegedly written by Trotta of Salerno. But Trotta of Salerno, we know, definitely wrote this bit that is like about midwifery. And it's like, here's how you like birth babies and stuff. And then what medieval people do is like when they want to get their cosmetic guide out. They just like start putting it together.
Oh, that's clever.
And then they're like, yeah, Trot of Salerno wrote this thing. And there's all sorts of things that you can do. So they make like face whitening powders. They've got regular old powder just to kind of like get the blot off. They make lipstick. They make blush. They have various kind of like washes that you can put over your face. And even people like Hildegard of Bingen had like, oh yeah, she was like a skincare girly. And she was all like, oh yeah, here's my like.
Isn't she a nun?
Yeah, she's a nun.
Oh, okay.
And she was all like, oh, here's like a really good like skin softener for if you've got like wind chapped.
What was her skin softener?
It was a barley water thing where you kind of like boil down barley with some varying flours and stuff. And apparently that works because I think there's like some glucose or something that kind of like comes off the barley.
Nice.
So yeah, so you know, they have these things. Some of them get quite wild though. So for example, like Depilatory creams, like in order to get rid of hair, because they really want that, you know, and they're doing their legs and they'll like do their pubes as well. Like it goes all the way.
Oh no.
Yeah, but they make some depilatory creams and baby, it's bad.
What do they put in
like, there? Some of them are like literally kind of like caustic.
Shit.
And so they'll be like, oh yeah, and it's like, this will definitely get rid of your hair. And then they're like, and here's what you put on afterwards on like them. And so like some of them are like nasty, right?
Come on, hit me.
Yeah, so like it starts off pretty nice and it's like, oh, there's iris root. And you're like, okay. Like iris root's in everything. I don't know why. So there's like, oh, there's iris root and there's camphor. Okay. And then they're like carbolic acid. And you're like, girl, what? And I'm like, hey, where am I coming up with this? But like, apparently they're like, that's around the joint.
Did they have Brazilians then?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, burnt flesh, but Brazilians.
Apparently they're like just straight up waxing and stuff like that big in the Italian lands.
I have read that actually. Mm-hmm, there was a lot of people coming back from Italy commenting on the fact that their courtesans didn't have pubic hair. So
yeah,
it
yeah.
must have been a thing.
It was a really big thing. And so like it's specifically talked about as things that women do to please their husbands. And it's, you know, kind of like right in there. Yeah.
Always. Actually, while we're talking about this, and I know that your book is like, it's focused a lot on women. Was anybody writing about what a fit man is in the medieval period? Did they have pot bellies and big asses?
Interestingly, there's these, I say interestingly because you're not going to be surprised. So the way of kind of thinking about the ideal woman and the ideal man is like really different in that like the ideal woman is a maiden. Maiden kind of describes this sort of liminal zone, kind of like we talk about teenagers.
Yeah.
Where it's like, so yeah, you are a virgin in theory, but it also is kind of like expressing this time of life where men think you're hot, but you haven't done anything about it.
Right.
So it's kind of like the promise of sexuality without like all of the, oh, now she's a slut. Kind
right.
of. So that's like it for women. So the ideal woman is kind of younger to the point where, you know, you will see things like if somebody's child dies, like in the Pearl poem, which is about a father who kind of like goes and sees his dead child in heaven and she like dies when she's two. In heaven, she's a maiden and she's like 20 because that's the ideal body and that's what you get.
Huh.
For men, middle age is ideal.
Oh,
which is so it's like
right.
in your 40s. That's like what the ideal man is.
That's so unfair.
And it's really sucks, right? Where it's kind of like, yeah, you just kind of like get there. And so this is a really interesting thing. If you ever see, for example, the Last Judgment paintings that you get from the medieval period when everyone's getting up out of their grave to like go see St. Michael and
yes,
be like, do
yes,
I get to go to heaven?
I know the ones.
And everybody's naked because like that's their little souls. And all the women look the same, like the ideal hot woman. And all the men are in their 40s. And it's just like, it's right? It's just so on the nose about
it's
what these things are.
Because they realize that teenage boys aren't
sexy. Yeah, cannot possibly be ideal. And that's kind of actually part of it because they're considered like so hot and dry, right? In humoral theory, it's like they're burning too hot. They're too wild with it.
Right.
And like they need to settle down a little bit. Whereas women, because they're colder and wetter, start out colder and wetter. You're just becoming colder and colder and wetter all the time. And that is kind of like what leads to death, it's thought. So like aging is thought of as a process of becoming colder and wetter over the life cycle.
God, that's right, okay.
So, you know, it's nothing that you won't hear from some incel now.
I mean, you get that if you look at most Hollywood films. Like, the guy is years and years older than mm-hmm. his leading lady.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the minute you turn, like, 26, it's like, all right, spinster.
TikTok.
Like, get in the closet with
you
that.
You are now too cold and wet.
Exactly. Like, we're not having it. So, you know, we haven't really come that far on that.
No, we really haven't, have we? God, that's depressing. Right, okay, so middle-aged men are hot in the medieval period.
Be back with Eleanor after this short break.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I'm looking for answers to the big questions about every aspect of life in the early modern period. Like, how did the memory of Anne Boleyn continue to influence the court of her daughter, Elizabeth I? How were fairies brought to life on the Elizabethan stage? And how did the arrival of male-only doctors threaten the lives of women? In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Subscribe now and follow me on Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Professor Susanna Lipscomb, and on my podcast, Not Just the Tudors from History Hit, I try to make sense of everything that baffled our early modern ancestors. Like, what do you do with your waste?
If you put your dunghill up against your neighbour's wall, you're going to cause rising damp.
Would Henry VIII ever consider executing his wife, the Queen of England, Anne Boleyn?
I'm not even sure if the Boleyns took it seriously, because why would they have any reason to suspect Henry VIII would really get rid of his queen?
And why do men grow beards?
During puberty, the male body heats up and a smoke rises in the body, pushes out the hair in the face. So the beard is actually a form of excrement.
In other words, not just the Tudors, but most definitely also the Tudors. Twice a week, every week. Listen and follow on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Right. One of the most interesting things about your book, and there's a lot in it that I really liked, but like you actually uncover a lot of jobs that women did, because we don't tend to think about, like when you think about what jobs do people have, mm-hmm. women have in the medieval period, and you kind of, you might think, none, possibly, mm-hmm. wife, mm. harlot, and that's your three.
And that's your three, right?
That's your three, yeah. That's what you've got.
And like, don't get me wrong, those are all available jobs, but the thing that we have to remember is that all those mums are also working. And, you know, there's a whole feminist point that we can make here about how, like, being a mom, rather a lot of work. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Please help. Especially in, you know, the medieval period when, like, you're probably going to die in childbirth in the first place.
Man, that's grim.
Which is grim. It's grim. And then it's like, when you have to make your own bread and, like, manually wash all of the stuff in your household, you know, and you are...
And make your own soap.
Make your own soap.
Yeah.
You're cooking dinner over an open fire. Like, you know, household work is just, like, so much more difficult. But you're still also doing other work. So, you know, obviously 80% to 85% of the European population are peasants. So you're also farming.
Did they know they were peasants?
Yeah. I mean, because for them, they're just like, I'm a farmer. That's what that
okay,
means. And then
right.
and that's what they do, right? And so... You know, you get up in the morning and you're plowing the fields and you're taking care of the animals and all of the regular old farmy chores. And there isn't anything that male peasants were doing that female peasants weren't doing.
Because you point out women blacksmiths.
Oh, yeah. So it's like when you get
I didn't know that.
Yeah, when you get to the trades, women are doing every single trade as well. Like, even to the point where we have examples of women mercenary soldiers or, like, women city guards.
Fuck off. What?
Yeah, so it's like women just, like, get around places. And we had...
Women mercenary guards?
Yeah. Like, girl, I'm just
Who
trying to get
they?
Paid. They were just cool. What? But, like, you know, like, when you're hiring a bunch of mercenaries, which people are doing, like, you don't really care. As long as they can swing a sword, who
I
cares?
I suppose that is true, isn't
you
it?
Know? So it's okay. Like, you know, there's always been sword lesbians, right? So it's representation. That's what matters.
Wow.
So basically, we know that at the Tower of London, there are several specific women blacksmiths. So, like, right...
You never hear about that.
And you never hear about it. And it happens for a couple of reasons, right? Because the first of all is that, like, when you're a woman and you're married, most of the time you're doing the same trade that your husband does.
Okay.
And then you also do the books for him, because it's like, that's feminized work, is the bookkeeping. But it's expected that when you get married, you probably do the same trade that your husband does, and that you're like a helpmeet. Okay. So if you are getting married, it's really likely also that you're going to marry someone who has the same trade as your dad, because you will have like been brought up knowing all about how to do that. And then that makes you a really good marriage prospect for other people. So we don't really hear about it, though, because of coverture, which is like the process by which when a woman gets married, it's kind of like Mr. and Mrs. Thomas Smith,
right,
or whatever. And then it's like, well, we don't even know her name. We just know that like she was here. Right. And it's really difficult to kind of like get people excited sometimes when you don't even know anybody's name or anything like that. So there's this kind of process of losing the women who are doing all these interesting trades that just kind of happens as a result of the way records are recorded.
Wow. What was the most unusual profession that you found? I mean, I know that you're well-versed in all this stuff, so it'd take a lot to shock you. Mm. But was there anything that you were just like, oh my God, a medieval female traffic warden?
I was really impressed by like the city guards stuff, because like mercenaries, I was like, okay, well, that kind of makes sense, because it's like, well, who really cares when it's like lads on parade, you know, or whatever. But city guards is really quite interesting, because that's like, oh, well, you're in your local community and everybody understands that she's doing this, and
yeah,
you know,
they're
willing to train her up along with the lads. So it says a lot more about connection to your community and then trusting you with kind of like having this level of physical capacity and being able to like mete out physical violence. Whereas, you know, with mercenaries, all you got to do is like being cut off from people is kind of the point of it, isn't it?
We've got to talk about nuns, because that is a profession.
It is. And like people forget about it, like it's a calling, but it is a profession.
It's also a punishment. We forget that's where the naughty girls went as
Yeah, you can get sent off to be a nun if you're a naughty girl. But the thing about being a nun is that you're not just like hanging out and praying. The entire point of kind of like being a monk or nun is this thing, they call it ora et labore. So praying and working.
Ora et labore.
Yeah, right. Prayers and work. And the work that you do is a couple of different things. Like there's the work to just kind of keep the convent running. So like somebody's got to be doing the gardening, someone's got to cook. But they're also doing all kinds of interesting things like copying manuscripts, making art. Like, so there's like a lot of librarian nuns, a lot of library girlies.
Okay.
Like that's going off big. But another thing that they do is they also a lot of times do work in their communities. So sometimes they work specifically in hospitals. So for example, at the Hotel Dieu in Paris, like there is a lot of nuns there who are working in hospitals. And the first hospitals really are monasteries and nunneries where anyone can just show up and be like, I'm sick, homie. And then they'll be like, oh yeah, here's your bed. And then you kind of get taken care of.
Right, okay. Right?
But this is kind of a double-edged sword, because sometimes nuns are working in hospitals, and sometimes it's like, I don't really know if you can let nuns work with sick people, because they're women, so they're so horny that they're gonna like shag their patients. Because it goes, like, I love it when he's got the pox, you know, or something. I don't know.
The plague is so sexy.
Yeah, and so, like, there is this kind of worry about it. So sometimes you'll have groups of nuns that work with the public, and then they'll be retracted. And it can kind of vary place to place. But it's quite an interesting one, because actually women are doing a lot of kind of medical work in the medieval period more generally. So it would make sense for nuns to be doing it, but there's just this kind of worry, because like the whole point is that you're not supposed to have sex when you're a nun, obviously. That doesn't always happen.
So like they would be there in the day, and then they'd have to say, I'm sorry, I'm not on the night shift because I might try and shag you.
Yeah. And then it's like the monks take over.
Of that, everyone feels much safer now.
Yeah, exactly, right. And it's like, you know, because they, like, if they're that apocalyptically horny, wouldn't they just like shag the patient during the day?
Yeah, you don't need to do. Did that ever happen?
I mean, I don't know. I can't say it didn't, to be fair, right?
In a thousand years of history,
like,
a
somebody
nun
did.
Must have shagged a patient.
Somebody
at some point,
did.
Right?
And then nuns get up to some stuff in the Middle Ages. Like, one of my favorite nuns ever, Joan of Leeds. Yeah, shout out. She ran off from being a nun, and like she does this like a huge ruse where she like makes a dummy of herself and puts it in bed, and everyone goes, oh, Joan is dead, and like she like lights out and like takes off with some guy, and they're like, oh, this is a dummy, oh hell, like, and then there's like an APB put out, they're like, everyone go find Joan, and the bishop is all, she has left her nunnery to pursue the way of carnal lust.
Go Joan.
And they never found her, I don't think.
I bet she went to Headingley.
Yeah.
There's a Wetherspoons there. I bet
there
that's
you go.
Where she
that's
is.
It. That's, she's
that's
still there
where Joan
to this day.
Still went on the WKD 2-for-1 deal.
Oh, we've all been there, you know.
Talk to me about education.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so this is quite an interesting one because women are excluded from some forms of education in the medieval period. Like, a woman can't really attend university.
Can't really, or just can't.
Well, this is the thing.
Ooh, okay.
So, in theory, they cannot. Because all members of the university have to be members of the clergy. And this is kind of like their way of keeping the lads out of trouble.
Okay.
So when they do something like run out on their tavern bill and don't pay it, instead of calling the cops because they're members of the church, you just tell the bishop and the bishop goes, lads, don't do it again. So women can't then go to university because they can't become clerics, essentially. So like that takes you out. However, you'll see examples of these women who pop up and they are kind of like teaching at the university. So like there's women we have on the records like teaching at Salerno and you're like, how did you get there? Like, how are you a professor? And they never explain it. They're just like, yeah, just her. What?
We don't know how to do that.
No. So it's like, I can't say that she didn't go to university, but it, like you're not supposed to.
What was he teaching?
She was teaching medicine. And a lot of the time with this, like medicine is this kind of like specifically feminine thing because the medical worker that you're probably going to see the most in your life if you're the average person in the Middle Ages is a midwife.
Yeah.
And so like midwives do, of course, help with labor and, you know, pregnancy and things like that. But they also just kind of see to everything. So it's like, you know, if you are in Headingley, you probably see the midwife when you have a cold.
Yeah.
And then she'll be like, okay, yeah, like I dug out some elecampane roots and like here's your tincture or whatever. You are probably not going to see a physician who's been like trained at Salerno or something like that. Because that's for rich people.
Right, yep.
That's like Bupa. Yeah, like they're going to show up at courts and they will maybe be working in like Paris or big cities like that. You're not going to see one of those
Mm-mm.
in your country town.
No.
But there becomes this interesting thing over the Middle Ages where in the later period to be a physician, you then have to have gone to university, which you didn't necessarily have to do before
okay.
that. And then someone is like, we got to sort all this out. Okay, like now you actually have to have like a degree in order to be a physician, which is why, you know, whenever anyone pulls that stupid thing about like, oh, PhDs aren't real doctors, MDs are, baby, no, PhDs as doctors was invented first. It was just physician for a really long time.
But we are shit in a medical emergency most of the time.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah, that's true. I will faint if you bleed. But
I mean,
anyway.
I'll have a go at it, though.
Okay. But like, so this is the thing. So as that goes on, it kind of like shuts down opportunities for a lot of women.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, I don't have a university degree, so am I a physician? But then there are still these weird loopholes because like women can sort of like buy licenses from the city. So like we see in Paris, women who are like, yeah, here's my physician license. And they're like, well, yep, all your papers are in order. So there are, people sort of know it's stupid. And there are obviously these workarounds.
Right, okay.
But there's like a lot of women who are doing it. Now, in terms of a regular old education for the average person though, women are doing a lot of the actual educating. So you see women as teachers all the time. So like women will be like teaching maths to a group of young boys. And you know, women are often the ones who are kind of like teaching rudimentary reading to their children and things like that. So it's kind of like a standard part of mothering is the basic numeracy. If you know you can read, your mom will have kind of like taught you how to do that. So women are involved at kind of the more regular levels of education, but the highest echelons, it's mostly men, except when a woman shows up and no one explains to me how she
Nobody
got there.
Like I read somewhere that when Cleopatra was supposed to seek royal advice, women weren't allowed to do it, so she put a fake beard on. I don't know if that's true.
I like that.
But maybe they just turned up, like in that scene in The Life of Brian,
yeah,
they've
and
all
they're
just
like,
got beards on.
And this is the thing, because it's interesting because when a woman shows up like that and she's at these really lofty levels of education and no one explains how she got there, it's sort of like, well, it can't have been that weird.
It can't have been that weird.
Because if it was really weird, they would have been like, here's my massive explanation about what this woman is doing here.
But it's like almost nonchalant. It's
yeah.
just barely worth yeah. even mentioning. That was just how accepted. God, that's fascinating, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It's really frustrating.
It's really frustrating. Who were they? How did they get there?
Yeah, and I'm like, I just want to know your life story, girl.
And were they wearing pretend beards?
Yeah.
Eleanor, I can't keep talking to you because you have to go and be fabulous on your book launch
That's right,
tour
baby.
Day. But, final question. If there is one thing from your book that you were desperate for people to get out, what would it be? I know that you want everyone to know that medieval people washed.
Yeah, that's a big one.
That's the hill that you will die on. But like, apart from that one, what kind of myth-busting thing?
I mean, that medieval women existed. You know, like half the time when you talk about medieval history, you could be forgiven for thinking there weren't any because people go, oh, like, well, there's Eleanor of Aquitaine.
There was four.
Yeah.
And one was a nun.
Yeah. And like, no one ever thinks about that. So, you know, there's this whole huge era of history where women existed and they're doing really interesting things and they're doing everything that men are. And, you know, history isn't just about like some douche with a sword who like starts wars. Like history is every single part of society and how people rub along. Mm. And it's kind of women that are making that go forward. And you know, it's interesting.
Absolutely. And if people want to know more about you and your book, where can they find you?
Yeah, you can find the book wherever good books are sold. You can check me out on Twitter while it's still alive.
Oh God, don't even.
At Going Medieval. I've got several very good and nice shows to watch on the History Hit Network, including one coming up that we are filming soon about medieval work and women in the Middle Ages, which will be very exciting.
Wow.
And yeah, you can check out my blog, which is going-medieval.com.
Thank you so much for talking to me today. This has been so much fun.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening, and thank you to Eleanor for joining me yet again. I really hope that she hurries up and writes another book, because it's just too much fun talking to her. And if you like what you heard, please don't forget to like, review, and subscribe wherever it is that you get your podcasts. And if you have something you'd like us to look into, if there's a history book that's just come out, or perhaps your favourite one and you want us to interview the author, you can now email us at betwixt@historyhit.com. Join me again, Betwixt the Sheets, the History of Sex, Scandal and Society, a podcast by History Hit.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Betwixt the Sheets. Please follow the show wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps us and you'll be doing us a big favour. Don't forget, you can also listen to all these podcasts ad-free and watch hundreds of documentaries when you subscribe at historyhit.com/subscribe. As a special gift, you can get your first 3 months for just £1 a month when you use the code BETWIXT at checkout.